Good morning, everybody. My name's Michael Roberts. I'll be chairing this little talk this morning. The topic we were talking about this morning, a few people when they registered wanted to know effectively what we're going to be talking about, because the title was a little bit vague. To be more specific, we're going to touch upon the age-old issue of legal professional privilege. Everybody thinks they know all about legal professional privilege. The reality of the situation is that quite often there's a few misunderstandings as to what documents are covered by privilege and the circumstances in which that privilege can be waived. We're going to have Adrian Muller is the first speaker this morning, and he's a barrister on the Greens list. He's been at the bar for a little while. Prior to coming to the bar, he was a senior associate in the dispute resolution group at Baker McKenzie Lawyers, where he advised and acted for Australian and international clients in a range of commercial and corporations matters, including shareholders' claims, directors' duties, compliance, corporate compliance and schemes of arrangement. Since he's come to the bar, he's appeared in trials in all courts and jurisdictions of our fair land. He's also actually been briefed to act in Western Australia. He's also experienced in alternate dispute resolution processes, a lot of us are, and he's been involved in proceedings involving ASIC. He's going to give us a bit of a refresher on the topic of privilege generally and the circumstances in which privilege can be waived. The second speaker this morning is Carolyn Simon. She's come to the bar more recently. She practices in the area of commercial and civil law. Prior to coming to the bar, she was the associate of both the Honourable Justice Gray of the Federal Court and also a good friend of mine, the Honourable Justice David Habersberger, who just recently retired. Before she was the associate to those two eminent judges, she did her articles at Norton Rose and worked in the insolvency area at that firm for a couple of years till 2010. Following on from what Adrian is going to speak to you about by way of background in respect of privilege and waiver, she's going to take you through a recent decision of Justice Armand arising out of the very unfortunate listeria outbreak with Jindy Cheese. And it's a very useful exercise. It's a case called Lactalis against Jindy. It was handed down a month or so ago, only 2 or 3 weeks ago, which deals with the issue of the circumstances in which counsel's or legal opinion can be waived by reference to that document in a court document. With that by way of background, I'd ask Adrian to commence. I think there's been a paper produced. Has that been handed around? Or?
No, it hasn't. There's a few things that need to be finalised. So the paper will be emailed to you, probably not today, but hopefully either tomorrow or on Monday.
And I should mention before Adrian starts that once my two colleagues have addressed you in relation to what they want to say, and subject to having a break at 8 o'clock, then it's proposed that there might be a few Dorothy Dixes thrown around to give you a bit of an idea, and I might also talk a bit about an example of a practical example in a case I was involved in a couple of years ago where the issue that subsequently Justice Vickery dealt with in relation to the dealing with experts in respect of how privilege isn't attracted by in dealing with experts. I can give you a bit of a practical example of the pitfalls that you encounter if you do it in the wrong way. So with that by way of background.
Thank you, Michael. The High Court has consistently said that privilege is a fundamental cornerstone of our administration of justice system, and it's always worthwhile at the start to stop and think, well, why is that? And when you have regard to the two limbs of privilege, which is advice privilege and legal professional privilege, why is it that we need this fundamental protection? What's it protecting us from, or who's it protecting us from? And when you think about it in terms of advice privilege, it is relatively straightforward. It's that a person should be able to go and see his or her lawyer and speak frankly with them and give instructions and receive legal advice about what their situation is without fear that that is going to somehow compromise other privileges that they have. And particularly if you're dealing in a criminal situation or if you're dealing in a situation where there's a regulator involved, where you might have other privileges such as the privilege to the right to silence or not to put on a defence until such time as other steps in proceedings have been taken, then knowing that you can have those conversations with your legal advisers and that they're they're subject to an immunity from attack or disclosure, is a, you can see how that becomes very quickly, you can very quickly see how that becomes a fundamental sort of protection that we need. It's interesting though when you turn to the second limb of it, which is the what we call the litigation privilege, or the protection for fundamental communications between a client, a lawyer, and sometimes a third person. And when you start to unpack that, you can see again, while it's important obviously for a person to be able to give instructions and receive legal advice, but it's not so readily apparent as to why that's so important. Of course, it's, when you think about it, it's important because strategy is very important in litigation. What you are compelled to disclose and when you are compelled to disclose it can be a very significant advantage to you in the conduct of a piece of litigation. So being able to manage that information flow is something that good litigation counsel are good at doing, and something that can give clients a real advantage. So as part of that, being able to, again, have those frank discussions, look at documents, copy documents in order to give advice about them or prepare the litigation is very important. Becomes even more important when you think that in civil litigation these days, and probably in a lot of criminal litigation as well, in the use of experts becomes very important. And there is a issue around once you give what might be a confidential communication that would otherwise, you know, without question attract professional privilege, to a third party, an expert, an accountant, a forensic person, a handwriting expert, that has lost that immediate connection of confidentiality that is a requirement of maintaining the privilege. But the courts have said, and said repeatedly, that the disclosure of those documents to a third person in that context in order to prepare a case for litigation is also fundamentally important to the administration of justice. Now that turns, particularly when you start looking at documents that might have been created rather than the oral instructions which are given to a lawyer in a conference, that starts to create some tensions. And the tension that the courts wrestled with for a long time was, well, if you create a document, how much of the purpose of that creation has to be for the legal proceedings or the giving or receiving of advice, and how much can it be for some other ancillary purpose? And for those of you who've been practicing a while, you'll remember that, just like me, when you started, there was a sole purpose test, and that was very difficult to manage. And then, thankfully, the courts moved us to a dominant purpose test, which we all thought to start with was terrific because that would be easy to deal with. But there's also tension in that test. You know, how dominant does the purpose of the creation of the document have to be in order to attract the privilege? And that came up in a case that was a young case, it's now an older case, the Singapore Airlines and Sydney Aircraft Corporation. And what happened in that case was a plane at Sydney Airport bumped into an air bridge, and that caused a significant amount of damage. And one of the things that happened sort of immediately after the accident was that an expert was commissioned to do a report, and the report was, the letter of instruction to the expert was under the heading Purpose of Report, and said that the report was commissioned in contemplation of litigation anticipated legal liability on behalf of Sydney Airport Corporations, and the contents to be kept strictly confidential and circulation limited. Now, most of us, prior to the decision being handed down, would have thought that was a pretty good go at making sure that the content of that material given to the expert and then the report that came back to the expert would be subject to the litigation privilege and wouldn't be compellable to be disclosed to the other side. But Justice McDougall had a different view on that, and he felt that the Airport Corporation had failed to satisfy the dominant purpose test because The report was commissioned for several purposes, which included its use in litigation, but he found that that was not the paramount purpose. So the test moved slightly, it seemed, from being a dominant purpose to when you've got a multiplicity of purposes to a paramount purpose. And he found that there were other purposes of the report, which included determining the cause of the incident and to ensure that similar incidents didn't happen again. And so that was the framework that he found that the dominant purpose of that report was not for the giving or receiving of legal advice or for the litigation privilege. He also held, though, and this I think is a useful thing to bear in mind, is that we often say quite tritely that the privilege belongs to the client. It doesn't belong to us who are lawyers. It's our client's privilege, and our client has the right to maintain that privilege or in circumstances to waive it. Justice McDougall held that when he was considering the relevant factors to do with whether or not this report should be subject to privilege, is that the purpose was to the purpose of the issuing of the letter of instruction and the gaining of the report was to be assessed from the view of the company, not from the view of the in-house counsel who was the person who had commissioned the report. And that obviously opened up a much broader scope of purpose, because while the litigation counsel for the airport had in her mind a focus very much of preparing a report for the use in litigation, because the company's purpose was much broader, Justice Dougal said that as a consequence of that, the dominant purpose was not as narrow as the dominant purpose might have been if it were just the being assessed from the position of the lawyer. In another case where there were lots of issues about documents which came out of the AWB litigation, there was a situation where a statement of contrition was drafted by AWB Chief Executive Officer and was circulated to senior management, an AWB in-house lawyer and a crisis management consultant. Now that sounds like a good job to have, doesn't it? I'll put that on the bottom of my business card, barrister and crisis management consultant. And Justice Young found that the privilege not attached to that document as it had not been created, again, for the dominant purpose of obtaining legal advice. Advice from the crisis management consultant that the company should over-apologise was considered to be a significant other purpose for the creation of the document. I could take you to other cases where there are other examples, but what comes from the cases is, if you like, a warning that if you're having a document created and it has multiple purposes, then there's an elevated risk that that document won't be held to be subject to privilege. So then there's the next question is, well, what do you do about that? And that's going to be a question for those of you who deal with in-house lawyers, something that should be on the forefront of their mind, perhaps much more than those of you who are in legal practice or at the bar, because in my case, nearly everything I do is subject to the litigation privilege almost without having to think about it, because nearly every document that I create is for the purpose of litigation. And then obviously once it's given to the other side, that privilege might be waived or whatever. But the creation of the document when I do it is very rarely for a dual purpose. If you're a solicitor if you're a solicitor in a law firm, then if you're in the litigation group, then you might find that, similar to me, that most of what you do easily falls within the dominant purpose of being produced for the purpose of litigation. If you're in an advisory role, though, it gets a lot more difficult. If you're preparing a due diligence report for the company, for example, then what's the purpose of that report being produced? Is it to give legal advice about a situation, or is that document going to be disseminated more widely and used for a purpose other than just the giving or receiving of legal advice? Will it be used to bolster some other position? Will it be provided as part of a package to say that the price should go up or down in the transaction? Once you move into those sorts of considerations, then you need to be much more attuned to what's in the document, because it's too late once the document has been disclosed to the other side, or compelled to be disclosed to the other side, to think, well, actually, maybe it would have been better if that paragraph had gone somewhere else. So I'm going to give you a few sort of tips about what to do in order to try and avoid that situation. And the first, and they're very practical considerations, the first is, think about, is it really necessary to refer to legal advice in a communication, or is there some other way that you can convey that? So if it's put in a written document and it's given to another person, that other person might be the client, then there's the risk that that person will then disclose the contents elsewhere and waive the confidential aspect of the requirement for the privilege. So the first and most obvious question to ask is, does the document need to be created in the first place? If it does, then you might ask yourself, well, should two documents be created, one which contains the legal advice which is given on restricted circulation, and another which contains the request for other purposes, or a sanitised version, if you like, that can be used to give to the crisis management consultant to say, what do you think about this as a manner of making an apology? Do you think this is from a media relation or a company, from the company's perspective, do you think this will satisfy what our what we want to put out into the marketplace? You can do that without having the, in most situations, without having the actual legal advice about the need or the rationale to do that sitting in the same document. And quite possibly, if that had happened in the AWB case, then what the crisis management consultant would have seen would have been much closer to the final press release and much less like the letter of advice that the lawyers had written. Another thing to think about is people often do this, and in fact in the Auslan case the government did it, is once you refer to legal advice in some other communication, then the courts have said that having regard to the circumstances in which you make that reference, should the content of that advice be disclosed. And it used to be on what was we called a fairness approach, was it fair to be able to still maintain the privilege having referred to the advice in some other form? And often the form would be, you know, I've been told by my lawyers that I've got a really strong case, and based on that you should pay me a lot of money. In the Auslan case, the government had sought advice about whether or not Ms. Auslan should be pardoned, and the Attorney General referred to that advice in the context of saying that there wasn't going to be a pardon. And the Court of Appeal and the High Court said that it wasn't so much a matter of fairness but of inconsistency. And was it inconsistent to maintain the privilege in the circumstances of the disclosure of the reference to the advice? And in the Auslan case, what the Court of Appeal said was that the purpose of disclosing that there had been advice sought from senior counsel was in order to reassure people that a proper process had been gone through and that the Attorney General had been acting on proper advice. And the court said that wasn't inconsistent with the maintaining of the privilege over the advice. And you can see how that's a different situation to someone who's saying, in, as I said in the first example, I've been told by my lawyers that I've got a terrific case. It's a really strong case, and you should pay me a lot of money because of that. In those circumstances, the court's likely to say, well, it's not consistent for you to have the benefit of the privilege, but also try to get the strategic benefit from being able to say, I've got my lawyer who's told me this is a great case. So the practical point that comes out of that is be very careful when you're referring to legal advice in passing in letters, particularly in auditor letters. That's an issue that will come up where the auditors write and say, tell us what litigation the company's got on foot at the moment and what provision should be made for the funding of the litigation or the payment of an amount on a claim. So again, managing that process is an important thing to do. If you do need to give legal advice or part of legal advice to third parties, then make sure that they understand that they need to restrict the use of that information. And again, that's often where briefings can be useful rather than actually giving people documents. So if you, for example, you might have an expert who you need to brief so that they can give an expert report. And as part of that, you want to give them an understanding of what's gone on in the matter and what sort of the legal issues are. And you might even want to go so far as to give them an indication of what the legal team thinks the critical legal issues are and what the prospects are on those. Now, one way to do that would be to hand the expert a letter of advice. And if you do that, there's a real risk that at some point someone's going to subpoena the expert and it's going to be disclosed, and then it's going to be very difficult for you to maintain the privilege over that. The other way, of course, to do it is to give the expert an oral briefing, and there's nothing improper about that, and there's nothing improper about asking them not to make a written record of that briefing. And then there's been the giving and the receiving of the advice. It's gone to a third party, but the risk that the third party will then disseminate has been greatly reduced. One thing that's a practical issue for lawyers is to remember that the privilege is not yours, it belongs to the client. So there are circumstances, obviously, where lawyers are and do waive privilege on behalf of their clients. And the important thing for lawyers to remember when we do that is that we should always be doing it on instructions. Now, sometimes those it's so obvious that the instructions are not formally needed. For example, up to the point that a statement of claim is filed and served, it's a document that clearly attracts legal professional privilege. It's been prepared in contemplation of anticipated litigation. But the moment that it's filed and served, then it loses the confidential aspect of it and is no longer a document that could be said to be subject to legal professional privilege. Now, I don't think many of us would run the client through the need to get instructions to waive in that situation, but it becomes obviously more critical when expert reports have been finalised and are about to be served, that up again, in most jurisdictions, up until the point that they're served, there's a privilege that attaches to that work. But after they're served, the report and lots of documents that have been produced around that report lose the privilege aspect of it. And so clients need to be warned about that in most situations. Again, when we're writing letters on behalf of clients, there would be an expectation that once the letter's sent, it would be waived. But if there's material in that letter that refers to privileged information, then instructions should be sought about those specific items before the letter is sent out, and the client should be reminded that that privilege is about to be waived in respect of those. And that takes us quite nicely to 8 o'clock. There's a lot more in the paper. So once you get the paper, hopefully that will give you a refresher. And I know I've skated over some of the concepts of confidentiality, but again, hopefully they're set out in the paper so that you can have a refresher about those.
Thank you, Adrian. What I propose is that we have a cup of coffee, or people refresh their coffee. Adrian's very handily touched on three or four little points that I've made in my on my pad that I think I might address before Carolyn starts on her point about the specific aspect of waiver, but I think he's raised a few interesting issues that I can probably give some guidance as to practical effect of acting in a particular manner in respect of privileged information, and I'll do that directly after we have a cup of coffee.